Welcome to Celebrity Book Club,
the podcast where we read the memoirs of pop culture icons so you don't have to.
I'm Carrie.
And I'm Kara. And today's book is Bossy Pants by Tina Fey.
I can't believe we're doing this.
I can't either. This is one that we have talked about for a long time. We knew we wanted to do eventually, but we didn't want to do it last season. And we thought it would be a great opener for season two, especially because we've both read it.
Yes, we have both read this book.
And we know a lot of people have as well, because it's been out for almost 10 years.
Yeah, and this book has been recommended to us so often. And I think we've been really hesitant to cover it. And I know we're going to get into that today.
Yeah.
I'm excited to see what direction this goes, because we've had a lot of off mic conversations about one Miss Tina Fey.
We surely have.
And now we're recording it. Now it's on record.
So get ready, everybody.
I remember loving this book at the time. I am curious what it was like for you to revisit it, because I think my opinions and relationship to Tina Fey has changed so much since then, but we'll get into that. So, Kara, you have also read this book.
I have, many times, actually.
Many? Many? More than once?
I think probably like 3 times total.
Wow.
And then I did like a skim/reread for this.
Wow. 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 Okay. So, since you've read this book multiple times, it seems like you will have no problem telling us what Bossy Pants is in 60 seconds. Your time starts now.
Okay. Bossy Pants tells the story of Tina Fey's journey from ugly duckling to successful swan. It talks about her relatively happy childhood, not without some, you know, standard run-of-the-mill bullying. She talks about her early theater experiences and her passion for performing and how that was sort of born. She talks about moving to Chicago, working a day job to survive, and then also eventually getting to work at Second City. She talks about her time writing for SNL and loving it, but having a hard time knowing when it was time to move on. She talks about the creation of 30 Rock, her relationship with SNL when she returned for the 2008 election cycle. And then she also sort of ends with talking about growing her family and reflecting on her life so far. And yeah, that's what this book is about.
Amazing. You nailed that.
Thank you.
That was like a beautiful 60 seconds. Exactly. That's so cool. I vividly remember the chapter, and I think about it often, of her getting the call to go back for Sarah Palin,
mm-hmm.
the Oprah episode of 30 Rock. And I believe she was also planning her kid's birthday at the time.
Yes. That's sort of the big like hullabaloo. That's like the big story chapter in this book.
It's definitely, I have thought about it often. And when I have rewatched that 30 Rock episode, which is now much harder to see because it is one of the ones that she preemptively pulled from the show.
Uh-huh.
But I often think about everything that was going on in her life at the same time. It's a real, and there's no way to not talk about Tina Fey's particular brand of feminism in this, but it's a real,
I can do it all. I can have it all.
Women can have it all kind of chapter.
Yeah.
And I think there was a time in my life where I found that so fascinating. And now I think, this goes back to my relationship with like fame and celebrities all the time. I'm like, I kind of don't care if you can have it all. Do the stuff you really want to do.
Yeah.
And if that's have kids and have a family, do that and like make sure that they're taken care of. And if they're taken care of by you or by a team of people and they seem happy with it, fine.
I feel like a lot of people, a lot of women in particular who we've read recently have had a phase in their life where they like take a break.
Yeah.
And either they got like started, I'm thinking of Demi Moore specifically, like she started so young, had such success, took time off to start her family, wasn't receiving a ton of support, but had to go back to work whenever she and Bruce Willis split up. It's just, it's interesting. And how neither is incorrect. It's just like, some people have a very clear picture of what they want their life to be. And I think some people want that like all the plates spinning at the same time.
Yes. And think you are superior for having all the plates spinning at the same time.
Think like, this is the way I do it. And like, this is the way that I can do it. So everyone should be able to do it. And people who aren't doing it just like aren't trying hard enough.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really tricky too, because the I can have it all thing so particularly applies to white feminism.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are so many women who have historically always had to work and raise a family. They never had the option of choosing.
The luxury.
Yeah. And Tina Fey also comes from a time where she was the only woman in the room.
Yeah.
And I think about this with Mindy Kaling too. These are people that
it's very specific.
Adapted their sensibilities to being the only person in the room. And while I think in both cases, they've paved the way for other people to join in.
Totally.
They start from a place of, we have to pitch it to these white men. I have to create content for these people because I was the only person. I have to prove that this story will work and be appealing to them. And so we've come so far in the past 10 years mm-hmm. that now that's considered pretty regressive.
Yeah.
And now it's like, I don't make my stuff for you. I don't make something to fit these people. And if it means less people see it, I'm okay with that. Right. I'm like
Broad City with Abby and Alana.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We are sort of hedging on this, but Carrie, what is your experience with Tina Fey?
I've done a lot of, not smack talk, but I've shared a lot of my reservations so far with Tina Fey. Here are the things I love about Tina Fey. I vividly remember seeing her on SNL. I remember her start on Weekend Update coincides with when I probably started watching SNL.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I remember seeing Mean Girls in the theater, like probably from like a promotional thing. I'm not sure how I got to see it, but I think I got to see it like a week early or something. Oh, cool. And it started and it was like, you get the first big laugh about the dinosaurs and the homosexuals.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, this movie's going to be funny. And then I see like the credits coming up as it goes and it says written by Tina Fey. And like, I think that is the moment that I learned that she wasn't just a person on SNL, but that she was a writer.
Oh, that's cool.
Besides the Buffy writer's room, Tina Fey is the first person and really the first person that I could put a face to of like, oh my God, she writes stuff. And I remember listening to, I love an audio commentary.
Love.
Audio commentary, the original podcast.
Yes. So true, Messi. And
Tina Fey's audio commentary for Mean Girls is so good.
I don't think I've ever listened to it.
Oh, I love it. I reference it all the time. She does so many funny things in there. And I just remember hearing her thought process and being like, oh, I'm obsessed with this. Because, again, audio commentaries are my life. I have listened to every episode of Buffy that has an audio commentary. I've listened to it. Mm-hmm. And so I would frequently, as soon as I got a new DVD, check out the audio commentaries.
Of course. I've done that with most of the 30 Rock ones that exist, actually.
See, and I don't think I've ever listened to any of those. And I bet it's great.
It is.
Her talking about her process was so sharp. And I just became very enamored with writers and the people telling the stories. And I think Tina Fey is like one of the first faces I can put that to, of that transition from I care about the people on screen to, oh no, I care about how it's made.
That's so cool.
Yeah. So I have a lot of love for Tina Fey.
You've never told me that story. I love that story.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember being like, oh, she wrote this?
That's
and
cool.
then it was funny the whole time, and not a women are funny big surprise moment, but a little like she was one of the first people to tell those stories that were very relevant to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was a victim of many a three-way calling debacle.
No.
Like, and all of those things and making them funny instead.
Mm-hmm.
It's complicated because there are so many people who Mean Girls was not that experience for them. It was like, reminds me of in Rachel Bloom's book when she talks about Never Been Kissed and how the kids got the wrong message from it.
Right. They watched it to learn the bullies
and they like the bullies tricks. And that happened for so many young people with Mean Girls of like, yep. It became
every school had a plastics.
The plastics became cool instead of like the biting commentary tale. On it. Yeah. And I had such a different reaction to it, but I know that not everyone shares that particular outlook on Mean Girls. But for me, it came at a time of like, oh, writing is super cool and writing funnily about traumatic things. Incredible.
I love that.
So yeah, that's my Tina Fey. And it has gotten more complicated with age, as I think kind of all of our celebrities do.
Totally.
The more work they put out and the longer you live, the sort of like less revolutionary you become in a lot of ways.
It's funny that you say that because there's a line in here towards the end where that I remember like reading it 10 years ago when it came out and sort of like chuckling at, but now I read it and it, one, has a very different connotation because the scope of American politics has become much more divisive, or has, but two, just reads completely differently now. There's a line in here where she's like, I can't remember what she's referencing, but she's like, it's one of those things everyone knows and doesn't talk about, but you shouldn't be ashamed of. Like going to bed at 9 p.m. or slowly turning into a Republican. It's funny that you say that because I feel like that's like and I remember like chuckling at that because that's the whole thing that like your parents told you, like when you get older, like you'll be more conservative.
I mean, not mine, but yes. Yes. For so many people that the arc of history has been like, oh, you're a young person. You care about other people. Oh, you're an old person. You care about yourself.
Yes.
Which
is hilarious.
And I do think that our generation are a lot of the people who are saying like, no, that's not it.
Great. Like if anything, I've become much more.
Every day I'm more radicalized. And of that is, like you were saying, the scope of our politics has changed so much.
Yes.
It's harder to see. And we talk about this all the time. It's harder to see how choosing your own best interests over the group
helps anything.
It's really hard to see how picking yourself over others in need is like how you can justify that choice.
Yeah.
Kara, what's your experience with one Miss Tina Fey?
I wrote this sentence and I'm going to read it verbatim because I believe it's true. So Tina, when asked how similar she is to Liz Lemon, always says that Liz Lemon is who she would be if she never met her husband. I think Tina Fey is who I would be if I never realized I was gay.
Yeah, I think that's 100% true.
I think there is a bite and a tilt to her writing and to her comedy that resonated with me as like a grumpy 17-year-old mm-hmm. because I felt cheated, you know, like out of life. You know, I was like, I'm smart, I'm cool, like I'm not one of the most popular people, but like, you know, it's so funny because so much of her original writing resonated with me.
Yeah.
And so much of it still does. And then I guess you get older and you get more life experience about your own experience and like who you are, but also experiences outside of your experience. I feel like I sound like I'm on drugs right now.
I don't think you sound like you're on drugs. I think there are a couple of things here that are interesting. I think the cultural climate during which Tina Fey became an icon was very, very different and gender was super binary. It was like
very true.
The peak of
the gender binary.
And with that, I think this may not be true for everywhere, but there's like a phase of kids comedy. I think that one day I will publish a book that outlines like what kids find funny when in their lives, because
you've said this before, yeah.
Because for second graders, they recently learned the oh, someone's behind you joke to try the made you look. Like a second grader loves a made you look, like mm-hmm. across the board. Just one of that's peak comedy. But I think for high school, which I would say for both of us is when Tina Fey was starting to permeate the culture, was starting to yes. break some comedic glass ceilings. Mm-hmm. There's something really edgy about gender comedy and race comedy. And like kids, when they're 14, have just learned about all these differences and want to like explore making jokes about these things. Mm-hmm. Always bad. Like they're bad.
Yeah.
And they haven't learned the difference between punching up and punching down yet. Like And that, and it leads to this really icky, bad phase of comedy. And Tina Fey plays with a lot of those same things.
That's interesting. Yes.
I think it's debatable. I think she attempts to punch up in those moments. But I think that when we were at the right age, we saw someone who was operating in the same world, but approaching it not as straight white man comedy.
Yeah.
It was straight white woman comedy, but for us, that's like, oh my God, what a difference. Change. It was a big difference.
It was a noticeable difference. Yeah, absolutely.
So I can see that. And I also like Tina Fey and Liz Lemon are such a part of your brand when I first met you.
That's, like, I was about to say, it's very, she was so in the culture.
Yes.
When I was like exiting high school, entering college.
Yep.
And I was such a fan of hers that like in a lot of people's brains, we became intertwined. The 2008 election cycle was right at the end of all of that. So that was sort of like, if you weren't a fan of 30 Rock or SNL.
You were in high school for that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because it was like, I was 1 year too young to be able to vote, but I was still like very much like in the...
It's a very specific time in your life when you care as much as everyone around you who's a little bit older about politics, but you have no say.
Which right, you can't really do anything about it yet. So you
fucking joke, we should let 16-year-olds vote. Again, we are radicals on this here podcast.
But yeah, I just remember having that exact experience that you're talking about of like, these are things that I know and comprehend and can't quite put into words. And here's someone saying a lot of those things and making jokes about them and like saying them in a way that's like interesting and sort of like pushing boundaries a little bit. And like, I don't know about you, but like, I had never really seen characters like that on TV before.
No, 30 Rock. I think the speed of the jokes, right? And that has become synonymous with her style is joke density. And like, that was revolutionary to have someone who was like, you're going to laugh and you're going to keep laughing. And there's no laugh track for you. You're just going to have to like,
you have to find it.
Confident. We're confident in what we're doing. It was badass. It was really cool.
Yeah.
I am thinking about your sentence about Tina Fey is what you would have become if you hadn't realized you were gay.
Yeah.
And we have to talk about an episode of 30 Rock that I think about all the time that hasn't really aged well. In my mind, hasn't really aged well.
Go.
Is the episode in season one where Jack sets Liz up on a date with a woman. And to me, the whole show can be solved right there. Like, that woman is beautiful. Like, it's just like, she's beautiful. Why are you so, and it's like a very, I'm grossed out about like the idea of licking pussy. Like,
right. And it's also that very, that gender binary. And also the whole thing of me as a 16-year-old seeing that, not knowing that I was gay, mm-hmm. but also seeing elements of Liz Lemon in myself, mm-hmm. like, you know, like kind of does her own thing. And like, you mm-hmm. know, maybe doesn't like, you know, thinks that like jeans and a sweater and a hoodie are like fancy.
Yep.
And likes Cheetos, you know? So there's like me identifying with and seeing all of that. And also like, you know, particularly in this case, being like unlucky in dating and relationships.
Sure.
Unlucky, quote unquote. So like seeing those things. And that's also like such a product of its time, right? Of like, here's this person who doesn't like present typically like feminine, but is straight. But so much of me personally, of my repression, is based in that moment.
Yeah.
And which was like a very culturally pervasive point of view, you know, that like if you dressed a little schlubby and mm-hmm. if you were like kind of awkward and like witty and like smart, and if you are XYZ, you must be
a
lesbian.
I used to worry that when people first met me, they thought I was gay. Like
all the time.
I was so worried about it. Why did I care so much? Like,
I have this really distinct memory of, well, when my high school graduation happened, our school rented like a boat to like drive us around the Inner Harbor for 2 hours so that people like wouldn't go get drunk.
Great.
And great. I remember like wearing this outfit that I really liked. And like, I thought I looked super cute. And I remember my mom like knocking on my door and me like turning to her and being like, okay, I think I'm ready. And then I like turned to her and I went, no, it was my dad. My dad knocked on my door and I was like, hey, I think I'm ready. Like, I think I'm gonna wear this. And then I was like, be honest, like, do I look like a lesbian? Cause I was wearing like a button down shirt and like mm-hmm. jeans. And my dad was like, kind of laughed and he was like, no. And then he like walked away and then came back and he was like, just don't wear those shoes.
The comedic timing and like the 2009-ness of that interaction yes. is yes. actually like would have been a really funny line on a sitcom at the time.
Yes. Like that would have been so funny. Do you know what I mean? Like
I do. I absolutely know what you mean. Yeah. I used to have a Justin Bieber style haircut and there mm-hmm. was a website called lesbianswholooklikejustinbieber.com that my friends used to threaten to put me on all the time. And I was so nervous about that. Like the idea that a picture of me was going to make people think I was a lesbian. And like, yep. there was so much internalized homophobia with all people in that particular time.
Yes.
In that particular time window, in the places we were living in, the way it mattered so much that people knew I was straight, like what right. was important to me, which I think about now is like, no, to like, quote A.D. Bryant on Watch What Happens Live, nobody's straight. My correct, all-time A.D. favorite Bryant. Quote.
Correct. Nobody, she like makes this face too.
Yeah, she does a full straight. Shrug and it's just like, nobody is straight. And she's right. Nobody she's is. Right. None of us are straight. Deal with it. You might be as close to straight as you can get on that spectrum, but you're not all the way there. Come on. No. You know it. I know it. Deal with it.
There is one more like thing that I wrote down that was sort of like an all-encompassing thing about my feelings about her. And I said, as I was rereading this, I realized just how formative this book was to me. There are pieces of wisdom in here that I've glommed onto and I quote or remember ever since I read this book 10 years ago. Some of these are parts that no longer seem authentic because one, I'm older now. And two, Tina Fey has achieved much more success since this was written. And the Ugly Duckling narrative doesn't really work anymore.
We have to talk about the fact that she is skinny and just has slightly bigger hips than some women. And we were supposed to believe that she was ugly.
Right. Or that she was like unconventionally beautiful.
She's stunning. She's as beautiful. Are so many people in so many ranges of body types. Like,
yeah.
Again, what I'm torn between is how much do we owe Tina Fey for breaking open some of these doors
mm-hmm.
versus like how much does her she, like, yes, she broke the glass ceiling, but it makes some of her work feel irrelevant now. It's a little like when we talk about Citizen Kane and it's like, that movie sucks. That's a boring movie now.
Right. And so another thing that I did write down was that Tina Fey is my problematic fave.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I still genuinely do love and respect so much of her work, especially for what it was at the time.
Yep.
But there are some things where I can be like, oh, I love blah. And everyone knows that, like, I don't mean that like all encompassingly, but yes. she's a person with whom I enjoy the things of hers that I enjoy so much. It feels irresponsible to not also be like, I get that she is a very specific thing.
Yeah. If Nora Ephron were alive right now, I would have to be doing a lot of the same thing that you have to do for Tina Fey.
Yeah. And I don't think that there is like a neat answer.
No.
Especially for someone whose work has meant and still in a lot of ways does mean a lot to me.
Yes.
But yeah, it was an interesting journey rereading the portion of this I read. Would you like to play Guess That Chapter?
I would love to. I'm so excited to. I don't remember the book that well anymore. I remember that chapter we already talked about a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I remember maybe one other chapter. So I'm curious to see if it's going to come flooding back to me once you do this. So
great.
Let's go.
So friends, here we are. Our first Guess That Chapter of season 2. Bossy Pants by Tina Fey is 276 pages, and we do not have time to cover the entire thing, although I am positive that we could. So instead, we pick one iconic chapter that stood out to us the most, which means it's time to play Guess That Chapter! Okay, I'm going to give you settings and characters. You ready?
Let's go.
Great. Tina Fey, Lorne Michaels, Alec Baldwin, Robert Carlock, Kay Cannon, Donald Glover, and the setting... The Big Apple.
Okay, so I think this is the only other chapter I really
remember. Yes, I knew.
So if I remember this correctly, so this is like some 30 Rock origin story stuff. And is this the same chapter where she goes through the list of writers?
Yes.
And says like their greatest hits?
Yes.
I think about this all the time because this is a kind of thing I like about Tina Fey, of like, she is ready to shout out her people. And if I remember correctly, she gives like their all-time best joke from the writer's room.
Yes, she hits like their some of her favorite episodes they wrote and then the best joke that they wrote.
Which I truly love that she does that. Also, like, let's take a beat and talk about the fact that Donald Glover was just writing on 30 Rock. Like,
In here, she taught in this chapter, she's like, he had just graduated from NYU and he was still living in the dorms as an RA.
His mind. I learned about Donald Glover through my now husband during our study abroad program. He was obsessed with his Derek comedy YouTube series that Donald Glover made all these like fantastic videos, like in the dorms of NYU, just like these like great, funny, dumb YouTube videos. And so like, I always feel like a person who like has been in the know of Donald Glover before other people. And I'm very, very happy for his success.
Yes.
He's a weird dude, but
for sure.
Why don't you go ahead and paint me a word picture?
Great. I'm going to do just that. So this chapter is called 30 Rock, : an experiment to confuse your grandparents.
She's just funny.
She is. She had been writing at SNL for several years and was kind of starting to feel like growing pains. She was like, people always compare SNL to like having a really good time in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Except at least in high school, they tell you like when you're supposed to graduate. And on SNL, you kind of have to decide for yourself. And so she was like expressing some of this to Lauren, and he was like, well, what if you pitch a sitcom? He was like, I think, you know, you have enough like clout at the network. And I think with like the right other people behind you,
yeah,
like you could, you know, have some success in this. So there's a lot of writing stuff in this chapter that like vividly sticks with me to this day. Like sentences that I quote verbatim that I've quoted for so long that I don't even remember they're from this anymore.
Wow.
She talks about when she was making the show about how she was really excited at the possibility of having herself, Alec Baldwin, and Tracy Morgan as characters, because in any conflict that came up, they would all have a different opinion and they would all agree and disagree in like endless combinations.
Yeah.
And in my brain, anytime I sit down to write something, I am literally always thinking about that.
Wow.
Yeah. About like, if we put like, why are these three people in this situation? I had forgotten that that was like why I think that way. And I read that and I was like, oh fuck. Like I got that from this book. The other thing that is in this chapter that I always talk about is when she's like, we wanted to make a comedic darling, but we messed up. Like we were trying to make Seinfeld and we failed.
Yeah.
And she says, especially at this time, so many people were trying to like find the special sauce and like recreate Friends. But what they didn't realize, and I've said this, I say this all the time. I know I've said it to you. I know I've said it on the pod. Friends was not the rule. It was the exception to the rule. And she talks about how she was nervous at like pitching this quirky, weird show with like all these different people and who, you know, weren't all hot. And she was like, it was tricky to get it through. And she was like, but it's so much more interesting to me to have a show that looks like real life as opposed to like six hot white 20 somethings.
Does this chapter go into the Rachel Dratch and Jenna Maroney of it all? And the Rachel Dratch and Jane Krakowski of it all? Or
it does not.
Does that even happen in the book?
No, I think that's just like information that's become public afterwards.
Okay.
Or not even afterwards, but I feel like she talks about it in some audio commentaries, actually. So it was like public information at the time. And then I don't actually think it's in here. But yeah, she sort of, you know, you said one of the chapters that you remember. She talks about her favorite episodes that each writer has, her favorite jokes that they each have, like, I just think it's so fun and like such a love letter to her writing staff. And it's one of the few moments where there's a lot of like self-effacing comedy in this book, which is sort of like her brand. But this is one of the moments where she is making like positive jokes about other people. And I think it just like really, I don't know, it's like very heartwarming in a way.
It makes it seem like she's a good boss.
Yes, yes.
It makes it seem like she'd be a fun person to work for.
I think she probably is.
It sounds like she appreciates the people around her, which I think is exactly how you would want to feel.
Yeah.
The thing I remember from this chapter is the way Tina Fey talks about how she never thought she was going to get all the people for it. Like, she couldn't believe she got Alec Baldwin. Like,
yes.
That part sticks with me of, like, she pitched a show with these things in mind and then it actually came to pass. And I think that's fascinating.
Yeah. And again, there's more of that self-effacing humor of, like, for some reason, Alec Baldwin, the network picked it up because they thought people would really resonate with something in the show, parentheses, Alec Baldwin.
Alec Baldwin.
You know, like, she completely denies her own, like, actual good idea at many points.
She does that a lot, I feel like.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But never in a way that I feel like is diminishing of her own accomplishments. It's just self-effacing in a way that's like, it's that, oh, we've talked about this before, that awareness that, like, she's proud of what she did, but she recognizes that it's, like, not the hardest thing ever.
Yeah.
You know, the whole, like, when Liz Lemon's parents come to visit and they're watching the Fart Doctor sketch,
mm-hmm.
they're like, we're just so proud of you and all the work you're doing here. And it, like, smash cuts to, like, them on the rehearsal stage doing the Fart Doctor. Like,
the way she minimizes comedy is both a thing that I really appreciate, but also is a problematic thing. And I was thinking about this as a mama let's research, but we got to talk about the cake. When she went on Weekend Update after Trump was elected and did the sometimes you've just got to eat some cake sketch.
I honestly am struggling to remember this. Keep talking.
Back to you. Okay. Yeah. So Trump is elected. She guests on Weekend Update and does basically a whole monologue about how, like, a really terrible thing happened. We thought something else was going to happen. And you know what? Sometimes there's nothing you can do about it. And you just got to, like, eat some cake. And it was it's really dismissive and it is trivializing. Yes, and there were so many people.
So much has happened. I completely forgot about that. Holy shit. Yeah.
And there are so many people, including people in my life, who really resonated with it. I was like, why are people attacking her for this? And you can want to be upset and take a break and comfort yourself.
For sure.
But it goes back to this thing we keep talking about of, like, choosing your own self-interest in that moment. What harm does that do to other people? Particularly if you have a platform like Tina Fey does.
Yeah.
Now, there has been a lot of talk lately because of the 30 Rock episodes that she pulled from her collection and things like that, that sometimes she takes responsibility as a way to protect her legacy.
Yeah.
Which I think is very true.
Yeah.
Because I think if you look at the message and the things that are happening within those episodes, there are lots of episodes that just don't have blackface that are saying something that is problematic or sometimes even completely despicable. Like,
yeah.
But she just took out the things where there was blackface.
Visual representations of blackface.
She is now at this point trying to make sure that she doesn't get canceled when in fact we all know that, like, canceling someone is just accepting the consequences and talking about, like, how I used to feel about this versus how I feel now. And, you know, it's okay that these things exist because I made them and I'm not trying to hide them from anyone.
Right.
Are you taking something away? Are you censoring it because it caused harm? Or are you trying to protect yourself? And it often comes across like Tina Fey is trying to protect herself.
It's funny that you bring up the episodes that were pulled because of blackface, because there's a line in here that I cringed at in this chapter. So she's talking about how we were trying to make a hit show. 30 Rock ended up not being that. Our ratings weren't terrible, but they weren't great, and we couldn't figure out why.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, no matter how many times we tried to course correct to make the show more accessible, slow the dialogue down, tell fewer stories per episode, stop putting people in blackface, the show would end up careening off the rails again. In my limited experience, shows are like children. You can teach them manners and dress them in little sailor suits, but in the end, they're going to be who they're going to be.
That's it. Like, that's it. That's the actual thing that she believes.
Yes. Like, she knows it's wrong. She knows that in several episodes, blackface was the butt of a joke.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have to be the butt of a joke.
It didn't.
There was a point attempting to be made that could have been made without the use of blackface.
Yep.
Everyone involved knew that and they chose to do it anyway. And that's the thing too, is that like, when, you know, when a lot of shows were having this reckoning last year, there was this thing of like the amount of people that would have to sign off on something like that before it went to air.
Yes. Yes.
It's like insane.
Yes. For a network show. Yes.
It was one thing for this group of white people to write this room, to write this these episodes with a 25-year, with one 25-year-old black man in the room.
Who, again, if we go back to what I was saying about young people and where their comedy is at a certain phase of their life, mm-hmm. it's edgy for the sake of being edgy.
Right, right.
Like, there isn't always a message behind it. I'm not, Donald Glover has done so many great things. I grew up watching his Derek comedy videos, and I'm going to tell you, there wasn't a lot of message behind B-boy stance. Like, there yep. wasn't. Like, it wasn't there. And that's okay, but it just wasn't there.
Exactly. And so it was that line in particular, to me, it was like the perfect encapsulation of like, she knows that some of the things she's done are wrong or tasteless or
yes
racist.
See, but she thinks it's tasteless but not racist,
right? Because if she thought it was racist, she wouldn't have done it.
Mm-mm.
Because she's like, I'm not racist,
it's just in bad form. It's yeah. a very I have black friends so I can do this, or like, I'm down, I help people, I do this other thing right, so it's okay that we're doing this. It's funny. It's for like, the joke is funny enough that it outweighs the racism is often how I feel like she's doing that mental math in her head.
And because in 30 Rock in particular, because Liz is the protagonist and we see the world through her eyes, like, we're frustrated when Jack is like talking about his conservative bullshit. We're mm-hmm. annoyed when Jenna is being a diva. We see this world through Liz's eyes. And we think when Tracy makes a request that it's stupid.
Yes.
And ridiculous. I mean, like, what I'm thinking of specifically is when they're in that restaurant in the pilot mm-hmm. and he's like, this is so fucked up. Like, all these white dudes are injecting AIDS into our chicken nuggets. And she gives him this look and is like, what white dudes? Like, it's something that she, as Liz Lemon, the character on yes. character level, has never had to think about. But it's also something that Tina Fey has never had to think about.
Yep.
And it plays in that moment because it's like, what are we, two characters with different opinions?
Yep.
It plays on that level, but there's a deeper, more insidious level to that
mm-hmm.
of we're aware that these two viewpoints exist and we're telling you which one is correct.
Yes. Because of who we've had as our
voice
protagonist. Yes.
Yes. Yes. And there are plenty of times in the show where Tracy surprisingly ends up like being right. You know, but like
ultimately, maybe Tracy's not a moron. Like that is an often a plot point of like, Tracy, that wasn't the dumbest thing you've ever said. Like, it's like, nah, bro. Nah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And again, having this absurd world with these absurdist characters lends itself to that type of situational comedy and that type of humor. But like, you have to consider the lens through which we're seeing those things. And like, it's not enough to have Grizzen.com be like, maybe one day we live in a world where you'll ask us to pretend to be scientists
mm-hmm.
when we keep seeing them as his bouncers, as his bodyguards.
It's so tricky because it's also such a funny show.
That's the thing too, is like, I think about that and like, I think about seeing whenever that episode aired, which was probably like, I don't know, like 2009, 2010, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people didn't say stuff like that on TV.
Yeah.
You know, people weren't like, maybe one day we'll live in a world where you ask us to pretend to be doctors. Like, people weren't saying that on TV. And so in my brain, I was like, oh, but they get it.
Yes.
They get it. Like, they get the surface level.
That's almost always what's happening, is it's like, they're in on the joke.
Right.
And they're in on like the casual racism of it all. Like, they know better. So it's okay when they do it. Right.
Right. But is it? It's not.
It reminds me of, it's like 10th grade all over again, of a bunch of kids being like, oh, my friends have diversified. I know all these people. I know this. So like, yeah, I can toy with this topic now because I have more lived experience. It's like, can you?
Yeah.
Actually,
and it's like, should you maybe just listen?
Should you? And like, It's tricky.
It is.
One last thing in this. Is this the chapter where she talks about how much she hates the 30 Rock pilot and she thinks it's really bad? Yes. And she just says, if you want to see a good pilot, watch Cheers.
Yes.
Yeah. I think about that all the time, is how much she hates that pilot. And anytime I've rewatched that pilot, I see the scenes. I see it and I'm like, oh, but me at 22 when this book came out was like, how could she say something bad about that pilot? Like,
yes,
it's interesting how so much has changed.
Yeah. And it's funny because, like, on paper, and it's also interesting because, like, you think now, like, a pilot doesn't have to be what it used to have to be. One, because of streaming, but two, because of, like, just the pace of everything is slower now.
Yes.
Like, even network stuff. And so, but back in, I mean, in 2006, like, you know, it was shit or get off the pot. Like, you had to give us all the information we needed in 22 minutes and 30 seconds. Like,
yes,
you had to give it all to us.
Right. You had to sell the show in that time. And it's so funny, like, even network shows will almost always get, like, a double length for their pilot. Like, you'll watch the 1 hour premiere of a sitcom, or you'll watch the whole night premiere of another show. Because
it's hard. It's hard to squeeze all that in there into 22 minutes. And they do an okay
job. There's a lot more forgiveness in television now, in what is expected of people to write and create in that time is so different.
I think viewers have raised their expectations, but also creators raise their expectations of the viewer.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, both of those things have gone up, I think, for comedy and for drama. I'm thinking specifically for drama, but, like, even comedy now is, like, a lot slower than it used to be. And you don't have to, like, explain as much anymore.
Mike Schur shows are the perfect example of that to me. He gets a lot of time to make his point.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, he comes from sort of the other house of where all of our comedy has come from, has either come from Greg Daniels or from Tina Fey. And really,
that's true. Wow. Holy shit. Yeah.
And realistically, all of our comedy has come from Mike Schur or Tina Fey, save for, like, Mindy Kaling gets a show every once in a while. I love her, but, like, Mike Schur is who got to make TV out of that world.
Yeah, totally.
Is there anything else you want to cover from this chapter?
I'll just read the last little paragraph that I wrote for Guess That Chapter.
Please do.
So I thought, Carrie, I thought this was a great chapter for us to talk about because I knew that we would be able to talk about, like, TV landscape, but also 30 Rock in particular. And it sort of hits the crux of my feelings about Tina Fey. Like, she has lots of problems, lots of successes, a dash of entitlement, great ideas, but that are being presented in a now pretty outdated way.
Yeah.
And I would love to see some sort of moral reckoning for her comedy in a larger stage, because I feel like a lot of it is good. And I feel like it needs to be as examined as it was praised.
Yeah. I have been in the middle of a Kimmy Schmidt rewatch.
Something that I could never really get on board with.
Oh, there's so much that I love about it. I think to pair her comedy with such a dark subject matter often leads to her really having, like, lessons in her comedy, which is, I think, a thing she has historically avoided. Like, 30 Rock, you don't, like, learn a lesson at the end of each episode.
Right.
But I do think you get comedy that is trying to point people in a different direction.
Okay.
And it is a mixed bag, but I recently got to the episode where Titus is putting on his one-man show about past lives, and he is playing a geisha. And that is such a clear opinion about how she feels about internet criticism. And
and
the idea that someone holding you accountable is someone looking for a problem.
Yeah.
That doesn't square with everything she's saying now about blackface. And now maybe she has changed.
Sure.
But so much of it to me feels like protecting her legacy.
It's also something that I was thinking about during the reading of this and during our discussion today, is that she's not on social media and has always said that she doesn't want to be. Which, I mean, I'm not, like, saying that everyone has to be on social media, but I think it's interesting that for someone whose work has been so highly lauded and highly criticized, like, if she had something she wanted to say and, like, wanted to defend herself, like, she has the platform with which to do that. And she's chosen not to. She's chosen to remain above the fray and to not roll around in the dirt with us plebes.
She does not interact with her critics or her fans.
Yeah.
And there's a part of me that's like, that's really cool, just don't do it. But she has an opinion about them, and she put that opinion into that episode of Kimmy Schmidt.
Exactly.
Well, mama, let's research.
Let us.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more Celebrity Book Club.
This episode of Celebrity Book Club is brought to you by Nicole Kidman thinking about death. If I was married to Keith Urban, I would have existential dread too.
Hey friends,
Celebrity Book Club has merch now.
You can find links to buy shirts, stickers, tote bags, and more on all our socials.
Check it out at Celeb Book Pod on Twitter and Instagram.
Carrie, what did you research?
I looked at two things. Oh, let's start with the 30 Rock blackface.
Great.
There's an incredible piece on the New York Times written in September of this year by Aisha Harris, who is one of my favorite culture critics of all time. And she did it's called A Brief Guide to 21st Century Blackface. And it's a taxonomy of sort of all the different ways that blackface has been used in media. Now, there have been other examples of blackface on 30 Rock, but the one that she references here is the idea of trading places as a form of blackface, which relates to the episode that aired in 2008 that is Believe in the Stars, in which Jenna and Tracy get in an argument over if it's worse to be a white woman or a black man. So they decide to do a Freaky Friday. She also talks about a similar episode of the Sarah Silverman program in 2007, where a black server insists that it's more difficult to be black and she insists it's harder to be Jewish. And so they do trading places. So she's talking about both of those things together. And Aisha Harris describes it as this. This strain of blackface, too, is self-aware. Other characters on the shows condemn Jenna and Sarah's stunts as racist. Jenna and Sarah both conclude that, yes, it is not easy being black, supposedly having learned hard lessons along the way. Still, it's hard not to come away with the feeling that the primary goal of this approach is provocation for its own sake, and that it's less self-aware than it thinks. This form of blackface is most representative of the oversights of progressive Hollywood. These episodes come with a built-in assumption that whiteface, or in the case of the waiter on Sarah Silverman, an anti-Semitic getup that includes a prosthetic nose and an I Love Money t-shirt, is equivalent to a white person in blackface without recognizing the unique role blackface plays in the history of American racism. These episodes purport to tackle racism, sexism, or anti-Semitism, and view blackface as simply an edgy prop for doing so. The idea of blackface as an edgy prop is exactly that's what 30 Rock is doing. They are using it as a prop to do something.
And it's like, why does it need to be the oppression Olympics? Like, can we not just, and even like saying the sentence, can we not just acknowledge that both, even saying, can we not just acknowledge that both of these are marginalized people? We should acknowledge that, but then we should also acknowledge the fact that as a black man, Tracy's life is harder than Jenna's. Which is like never the thing that they're both like, wow, life is hard, you know, like,
and is that subject? The thing is like 2008, is that a topic that hasn't already been addressed? Like to me, it feels very obvious. Like
I remember like watching that in 2008 and being like, this is not okay. Like, even understanding like why they were doing it in the show, but like still watching it and being like, well, that's not okay. I feel like if you have to defend your use of it in a way like that, then it is like this author says, it's just a prop.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. The other thing I want to talk about is the sheet cake, which we did go into a little. I pulled up a Washington Post article about it. Few things to clarify. It is not when Trump is first elected. It is after Charlottesville, which does make it 10 times worse.
That's right.
Again, hindsight is 2020. We have now seen so many examples of white supremacist insurrection and like deeply, deeply upsetting things. And homegirl's just like, let me eat a sheet cake. And so she says, this is what she says on the sketch. I know a lot of us are feeling anxious. We're asking ourselves, what can I do? I'm just one person. What can I do? Order a cake with the American flag on it, like this one, and just eat it. And so she just keeps eating the cake throughout the thing. So her thought after, you know, white supremacy is on blatant display and like a woman lost her life trying to stop it from happening. People were injured. Cars were driven into black people like en masse. She's like, no, a sheet cake. That's the move. Ugh. Ugh, Tina Fey. Ugh. Yeah. But so she goes on Letterman's show. He says that he's a fan of it, and he says, I marveled at it for the writing of it and the execution of it. I thought it was perfect. Tina Fey says, turns out it was not, sir. Oh. She also, like, in the sketch says to people, don't show up, let these morons scream into the empty air. Like, she's basically saying, like, don't do anything about it.
Yeah. Like, don't counter protest.
So she says, every time I've done some kind of those update things, I always step in manure. The implication was that I was telling people to give up and not be active and not fight. And that was not my intention, obviously. The idea was, if you feed these kind of trolls, if you don't, if you take the air out of it, they disappear faster. And I didn't want any more people to get hurt. If I could put one sentence back in digitally, I would say, fight them in every way except the way they want. Hmm. She, like, almost gets it.
Yeah.
And she does have a point of view that is like, don't amplify them.
Sure. Which is true and correct.
Which, as I think about that, has a lot to do with maybe why she's not on social media, right? Like, she views that as like an amplification chamber for evil,
mm-hmm.
and doesn't see it as
an organization tool.
An organizational tool or any kind of like democratic platform where more voices are shared.
Mm-hmm.
There's a version in which she's right. And there is also still this thing that she's missing out on.
Yeah, totally.
Which fits perfectly into our Tina Fey narrative of like, there's a lot
I almost got it. Yeah.
Just is missing this other thing that I need her to see, that like, I want to shake her and have her figure it out.
Yeah. We need to like Ebenezer Scrooge her into realizing that racism is real.
Oh my God.
Can we franchise this?
Can we franchise this? Great. Great. Mama, what'd you research?
I looked up a review of season one of 30 Rock from 2007 when it came out. And much like everything that I looked up recently, it was a time capsule of what the world was like in 2007. The review was basically like, I was surprised at how much I liked the show. I mean, it was like an amateur reviewer. It was like from Den of Geek or something. It was like,
Keep going.
Incels who voted for Obama, but whatever. It was like, I was surprised at how much I liked the show. I didn't really like Tina Fey on SNL, but I did love her alter ego of Liz Lemon, which is like, you hear that sentence.
Mm-hmm.
It fills you with annoyance and rage and probably a little bit. And you think about Tina Fey reading that sentence in the year 2007.
Yep.
And being like, this is what I'm fighting against.
Everything about that takes me to a place of like uterus feminism of like, oh, you don't like her because she's a woman. Like, it instantly makes me go to the very thing that like is why I was drawn to Tina Fey in the first place. And it's exactly. Like, bitch, you didn't like her on SNL. She wrote all your favorite sketches. Everything you laughed at on SNL, she wrote. But like, wrote. Sure. Yeah. You didn't like her when she was sitting next to your when boy, Jimmy Weekend Fallon. Update. Yeah, when exactly. James Fallon laughed at his own joke every 30 seconds and she had to like sit there and take it. Oh, yeah, she was the problem with that.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. So once again, I was like, this is a time capsule of what the world was like in that moment, of how I can see how she would read that and probably been encountering that for 10 years prior and been like, fuck you. You think you're better than me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to write on the most popular late night comedy show. I'm going to make my own TV show.
Yep.
It's going to be packaged in a way that's appealing to you. You're going to be laughing at my jokes.
Even though you don't like me. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot. It's that revenge thing of like, I fucking hate you. Now you will like me and I will still despise you.
It's like revenge porn, but with comedy. I don't know if that's a metaphor that tracks.
It does. It's like revenge success.
There you go. It's like the opposite of revenge porn. Wrapping up here, it's time.
We doing this?
For our new segment.
You voted. You made your voices heard. The will of the people has won. We did not cheat and pick our own favorite. And that is in large part because our favorite won. So it is time to play for the first time this season. Six degrees. Of Don Cheadle.
Yes!
I'm excited to see all the different directions we can go in.
Do you want to hear the direction that I went in?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, great. Actually, believe it or not, Don Cheadle's career is so vast and extensive that I was able to do this very quickly, and I was also able to do it two ways.
Whoa, let's go.
Okay, so Tina Fey was in this movie Admission with Paul Rudd. She plays like a Harvard.
Oh, no, Princeton. I saw that movie in theaters. It's a weird little movie.
It's weird, but it's like fun.
It really is like the last time that studios just had money to like make bad movies. It's just not very good. Like, it's fine. It's fine. But someone like looked at that script and was like, yeah, we'll give you a budget and you can make this movie.
With Tina Fey and Paul Rudd.
Exactly.
So anyway, they're in that movie. Paul Rudd is in various Marvel Cinematic Universe.
True.
As, I believe, the Ant-Man. Is that true?
Yes, as the Ant-Man. That is true.
And Don Cheadle is in various Marvel Cinematic Universe movies as War Machine.
Is that his robot's name? I love being able to bring to you the straight culture that is the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I do not often want to be the ambassador for straight culture, even though I am. And this is an area in which I can help you. Yes, he plays War Machine.
Great. Well, boom, boom, boom. 3 degrees. Boom.
Beautiful.
Also, if you want no degrees of separation,
hit it.
It's 2013. Tina Fey and Amy Poehler presented at the Golden Globes. Don Cheadle won Best Actor for House of Lies.
Yeah, he did. Fantastic.
Your turn.
Tina Fey was a writer and star on SNL with known sex addict Fred Armisen. Fred Armisen plays a voice on Big Mouth. He is Nick Kroll's dad's voice on Big Mouth. I don't remember the character names. Big Mouth fans at me. Fred Armisen voices a character on Big Mouth. Another character on Big Mouth is voiced by one Mr. Andrew Rannells. I also don't remember that character's name. Sorry, guys. I watch it as soon as it comes out, and then I just forget about all these people. Andrew Rannells stars in the show Black Monday with Don Cheadle. So I think that's 4 degrees, but uh-huh. I'm pretty pleased with it. It lets me touch on a lot of things that I like, and I got to call out Fred Armisen for being a sex addict. One of my favorite things to do.
Putting Fred Armisen on blast.
Also, like, addiction is a disease, but for some reason, sex addiction to me is like, that's not real.
it's the whole, you know it when you see it, right?
Yeah.
And that definition is different for everybody, which is why it's impossible. There's so much, you know, not to get current eventy, but there's so much going on right now with all sorts of legislation being passed that's like regulation of sex work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, when the definition is what the legal definition is, it's impossible to regulate in a way
that's super murky.
Almost completely destroy the industry.
Yes. So it's a complicated thing. I should probably give more grace to Fred Armisen, but I don't think I'm starting that today. But I know I should. So that's where I am.
There you go. It's the first step.
Kara, we've discussed a little bit already how we would franchise this.
Yes, and that's my only answer. I want to Ebenezer Scrooge Tina Fey into realizing that she's done some racist things.
Yeah. And I think it's, for me, it's beyond just she's done some racist things. I want to Ebenezer Scrooge her into some level of accountability.
Mm.
Of like listening to the people around her and thinking about the harm that she's caused and how to do something with that. That's what I'm looking for.
Like, you don't want her to just wake up and be like, oh, here's 5 cents to go buy the turkey in the window. You want to be like, no, bitch, buy Bob Cratchit Thanksgiving or Christmas dinner for his whole ass family. Pay for Tiny Tim's medical bills.
Yeah, pay for Tiny Tim's medical bills. Give Bob Cratchit a raise. Support all the other. Here's what I was really going to say, because to me, it's a Muppets Christmas Carol that I'm thinking of. It's like, so what I'm about to say is give all the rats who work in your shop more heat. Let them add more coal to the fire. Like, be a decent person. Like, yes. That's
more coal to the fire. Okay. It's so funny because literally in my brain, I was also tracking through. I was like, what does Michael Caine do in Muppets Christmas Carol? What are the things that he says?
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, one of the best movies of all time, I think.
Yep. Yep. You know, it's February, but sure. We're still talking about Muppets A Christmas Carol.
I'm always talking about Muppets Christmas Carol. I would watch that movie pretty much any time
of
year.
Good point. It has no season.
It's timeless.
Timeless.
Seasonless.
Seasonless. All year long, be watching Muppets A Christmas Carol. All right. Each week, Kara and I play Guess That Chapter, but it's time for you, the listener, to guess that author. I'm reading the book for next week, so here are your clues. My first clue is, I do know her. My second clue is, I'd climb into her for any day. And my third clue is, I wish she thought I smelled like sweet bread plums and grilled cheese sandwiches. So catch you next week for this book.
If you have a guess for next week's author, you can find us at Celeb Book Pod on Twitter and Instagram.
Kara can be found on Twitter and Instagram at _KPRO. That's _KAYPRO.
Carrie can be found on Twitter and Instagram at CFOST Talks A Lot. That's the letter CFOST Talks A Lot.
Thanks for listening to Celebrity Book Club.